air and into orderliness. Even before the lodgers reached the room, she had finished making up the beds and slipped out. Gregor's father appeared to be once more so firmly in the grip of his own stubbornness that he forgot the basic respect that, after all, he owed his tenants. He kept up his pressing and urging until, already standing in the doorway, the middle lodger thunderously stamped his foot, causing Gregor's father to stop short. "I hereby declare," he said, raising his hand and seeking out Gregor's mother and sister, too, as he glanced about, "that in consideration of the reprehensible circumstances prevailing in this apartment and family," and here he spat on the floor without forethought, "I give notice on my room effective immediately. It goes without saying that I will not pay a penny for the days I've spent here. On the contrary, I shall consider whether or not to pursue you with, please believe me, easily justifiable claims." He fell silent, and went on looking straight before him expectantly. And indeed his two friends at once chimed in with the words, "We too give notice effective immediately." Hereupon he seized the door handle, and with a great crash, slammed the door. Gregor's father staggered to his armchair with groping hands and let himself fall into it. It looked as though he was stretching out for his customary evening nap, but the violent nodding of his anchorless head showed that he was absolutely not sleeping. Gregor had gone on lying quietly on the spot where the lodgers had espied him. His disappointment at the failure of his plan, and perhaps also the weakness caused by starvation, rendered him incapable of moving. With a certain definitiveness, he sensed, terrified, that everything was about to collapse all around him. And so he waited. Not even the violin startled him when it fell from his mother's lap beneath her trembling fingers, giving off a note that echoed in the air. "Dear parents," his sister said, striking the table by way of preamble, "things cannot go on like this. Even if you two, perhaps, do not realize it, I most certainly do. I am unwilling to utter my brother's name before this creature, and therefore will say only, we have to try to get rid of it. We have done everything humanly possible to care for it and show it tolerance. I don't think anyone would reproach us on this account."
"She is right 1,000 times over,
Gregor's father murmured under his breath. His mother, still incapable of breathing freely, began to cough dully into her lifted hand, a lunatic expression in her eyes. Gregor's sister hurried over to her mother and held her forehead. Her words seemed to have given her father an idea, for he now sat up straight, playing with his uniform cap beneath the plates left behind on the table from the lodger's supper and glancing over from time to time at a quiet Gregor. "We have to try to get rid of it," his sister said, addressing her words exclusively to Gregor's father this time, for his mother was coughing too hard to hear anything. "It'll be the death of you two, I can see it now. When people have to work as hard as all of us have been doing, it just isn't possible to endure these endless torments at home. I cannot bear it any more either." And she burst into sobs, weeping so forcefully that her tears flowed down upon her mother's face, from which the girl wiped them with a mechanical gesture. "Child," her father said sympathetically and with noticeable compassion, "but what can we do?" Gregor's sister just shrugged her shoulders as a sign of the helplessness that had come over her while she was weeping, in contrast to the confidence she'd displayed a moment before.
"If he understood us," Gregor's father said, half-questioning.
His sister, still caught up in her weeping, shook one hand vehemently as a sign of how unthinkable she found this.
"If he understood us," his father repeated, closing his eyes to absorb her conviction that this was utterly out of the question, "then it might be possible to come to an agreement with him. But as things stand..."
"It has to go," Gregor's sister cried out. "That's the only way, father. You just have to try to let go of the notion that this thing is Gregor. The real disaster is that we believed this for so long. But how could it be Gregor? If it were Gregor, it would have realized a long time ago that it just isn't possible for human beings to live beside such a creature, and it would have gone away on its own. We still would have been lacking a brother, but we would have been able to go on living and honoring his memory. But now, we have this beast tormenting us. It drives away our lodgers and apparently intends to take over the entire apartment and have us sleep in the gutter. Just look, Father! She suddenly shrieked. He's starting again! And in a fright that Gregor found bewildering, she now went so far as to leave her mother behind, launching herself from her chair as if she would rather sacrifice her mother than remain in Gregor's proximity, and ran to take cover behind her father, who, agitated by the way she was carrying on, rose from his own chair and half raised his arms as if to shield her. But Gregor was far from wanting to frighten anyone, above all his sister. All he'd done was start to turn around to make his way back to his room, and admittedly this operation would have been hard not to notice, since in his current injured state he was obliged to use his head to help with this difficult maneuver. He kept raising it up and then thumping it against the floor. Pausing, he glanced around. His good intentions seemed to have been recognized. It had been only a momentary fright. Now all of them gazed at him sadly and in silence. His mother lay in her armchair, her extended legs pressed together, barely able to keep her eyes open in her exhaustion. His father and sister sat side by side, and his sister had draped one hand across her father's neck. "Perhaps I'll be allowed to turn around now," Gregor thought, and resumed his labors. He could not entirely suppress the wheezing this exertion produced, and now and then he had to rest. Otherwise, no one was harassing him. He had been left to attend to matters on his own. When he had completed this rotation, he immediately made straight for the door to his room. He was astonished at how great a distance separated him from his destination, and he didn't understand how, weak as he was, he had been able to traverse the same distance just a little while before, almost without noticing. Steadfastly concentrating only on crawling as quickly as possible, he scarcely paid any heed to the fact that not a word, not a cry, came from his family to disturb him. Only when he was already in the doorway did he turn his head, not all the way around as he felt his neck growing stiff, but even so, he was able to see that all was unchanged behind him, except that his sister had risen to her feet. The last thing he saw was a glimpse of his mother, who had now fallen entirely asleep. No sooner was he in his room again than the door was hastily pressed shut, locked and bolted. The sudden commotion at his back gave him such a frightful start that his little legs gave way beneath him. It was his sister who had hurried thus. She had already been standing there upright and waiting, then pounced so light-footedly Gregor didn't hear her approach, and she cried out, "Finally!" to her parents as she turned the key in the lock. "And now?" Gregor wondered, looking around in the dark. He soon made the discovery that he was no longer capable of moving at all. He wasn't surprised at this. On the contrary, it struck him as unnatural that he had actually until now been able to support himself on those thin little legs. As for the rest, he felt relatively at ease. Admittedly, his entire body was racked with pain, but it seemed to him as if it was gradually becoming weaker and weaker, and in the end would fade away altogether. Already he could scarcely feel the rotting apple in his back, nor the inflamed area surrounding it, both now enveloped in soft dust. He thought back on his family with tenderness and love. His opinion that he must by all means disappear was possibly even more emphatic than that of his sister. He remained in this state of empty, peaceful reflection until the clock tower struck the third hour of morning. He watched as everything began to lighten outside his window. Then his head sank all the way to the floor without volition, and from his nostrils, his last breath faintly streamed. When the charwoman arrived early the next morning, slamming the door so loudly in her strength and haste, often as she'd been asked to avoid this, that sleep was out of the question anywhere in the apartment after her arrival. Her usual cursory visit to Gregor's room revealed at first nothing out of the ordinary. She thought he was lying there so motionless on purpose, feigning indignation. She considered him perfectly capable of rational thought.
since she happened to be holding the long broom in her hand. She tried tickling Gregor with it from the doorway. When even this had no effect, she grew vexed and began to poke Gregor a little. And only when she had actually shifted him from the spot where he lay with no resistance at all were her suspicions roused. When soon thereafter the facts of the matter became clear to her, she gawked in surprise, gave a low whistle, then without further delay flung open the door of the bedroom, and in a loud voice shouted into the darkness, "Come have a look! It's gone and croaked, just lying there, dead as a doornail!" The Samsa couple shot upright in their marital bed, and first had to struggle to recover from their shock at the charwoman's conduct before they were able to grasp her words. But then Hare and Frau Samsa hurriedly got out of bed, one on either side. Herr Samsa threw the blanket about his shoulders, while Frau Samsa emerged wearing only her nightdress. In this state, they entered Gregor's room. Meanwhile, the door to the living room, where Greta had been sleeping since the lodger's arrival, had opened as well. She was fully dressed, as though she had not slept at all, as even the pallor of her cheeks seemed to prove. "Dead?" Frau Samsa asked, looking questioningly up at the charwoman, although she herself was free to investigate, and indeed could see how things stood even without investigation. "I should say so," the charwoman said, and by way of proof pushed Gregor's corpse quite some way to the side with her broom. Frau Samsa made a gesture as though she wanted to hold back the broom, but didn't. "Well," Herr Samsa said, "now we can thank God." He crossed himself, and the three women followed his example. Greta, who did not take her eyes off the corpse for a moment, said, "Just look how skinny he was. He went such a long time without eating anything at all. All the food that went into his room would come out again just as before." And indeed, Gregor's body was completely flat and dry, which hadn't really been noticeable until now, when he was no longer raised up on those little legs, and nothing else remained to distract the gaze. "Greta, come sit with us for a bit," Frau Samsa said with a melancholy smile, and Greta, glancing back at the corpse, followed her parents into their bedroom. The charwoman shut the door and opened the window wide. Despite the early morning, the crisp air was already tempered by a certain mildness. After all, it was already the end of March. The three lodgers now emerged from their room and looked about in astonishment for their breakfast. They had been forgotten. "Where's breakfast?" the one in the middle asked the charwoman peevishly. But she just put a finger to her lips and then quickly, without a word, beckoned the lodgers into Gregor's room. They did as she bade them, and with their hands in the pockets of their slightly threadbare little jackets, they surrounded Gregor's corpse in the room that had meanwhile become quite bright. Then the bedroom door opened, and Herr Samsa appeared wearing his livery, with his wife on one arm, his daughter on the other. All three looked as if they'd been weeping. Greta kept pressing her face against her father's arm. "Leave my home at once," Herr Samsa said, pointing at the door without letting go of the womenfolk. "What do you mean?" the gentleman in the middle inquired, dumbfounded, and gave a saccharine smile. The two others held their hands at their backs and kept rubbing them together uninterruptedly, as if in gleeful expectation of a fight that was certain to be decided in their favor. "I mean exactly what I say," Herr Samsa replied, now advancing on the lodger flanked by his two companions. The lodger just stood there at first, looking at the ground, as if things were just rearranging themselves in his head into a new order. "So we'll be leaving," he said then, looking up at Herr Samsa, as if this new humility that had suddenly come over him required him to petition for the approval of even this decision. Herr Samsa merely nodded curtly in his direction a few times, goggle-eyed. At this, the gentleman did, in fact, make haste to stride back out to the vestibule, where his two friends had been listening attentively for some moments, their hands at rest, and now they practically hopped and skipped in their hurry to follow, as if worried Herr Samsa might somehow precede them into the vestibule, cutting off their line of communication with their leader. In the vestibule, all three of them took their hats from the coat rack, withdrew their walking sticks from the cane stand, made a silent bow, and left the apartment. Displaying what soon proved to be an utterly unfounded mistrustfulness, Herr Samsa stepped out onto the landing with the two women. Leaning against the banister, they watched as the three gentlemen descended the long staircase, moving slowly but at a steady pace and disappearing on each floor at a certain bend of the stairwell, only to appear again a few moments later. The farther down they went, the more the Samsa family's interest in them faded, and when a butcher's apprentice came toward and then passed them on his way up, proudly bearing his tray upon his head, Herr Samsa and the women abandoned the banister, and all of them returned, seemingly relieved, to their apartment. They decided to spend the day resting and to go out for a stroll. They had not only earned this respite from their work, but were desperately in need of it. And so they all sat down at the table and wrote three letters of excuse. Herr Samsa to his supervisor, Frau Samsa to her employer, and Greta to her superior. While they were writing, the charwoman came in to say she was leaving, as her morning's work was completed. The three scribes at first merely nodded without looking up, and only when the charwoman failed to go on her way did they glance up in annoyance. "Well?" Herr Samsa asked. The charwoman stood smiling in the doorway, as if she had some splendid good fortune to announce to the family, but would not do so until she was properly questioned. The nearly vertical little ostrich feathers on her hat, which had annoyed Herr Samsa for as long as she had been in the family service, bobbed gently in all directions. "So what is it you want?" she was asked now by Frau Samsa, the member of the family for whom the charwoman still had the most respect. "Well," the charwoman replied, her own good-natured laughter making it impossible at first for her to go on speaking. "There's no need for you to go worrying about how to get rid of that mess in there. It's already taken care of." Frau Samsa and Greta bent down over their letters as if they meant to go on writing. Herr Samsa, who saw that the charwoman was about to start describing everything in detail, summarily silenced her with an outstretched hand. And since she was not permitted to say what she wished, she suddenly remembered the great hurry she was in. And so, with an insulted air, she cried, "So long, everyone!" turned wildly on her heel, and with the most excruciating slamming of doors, left the apartment. "Tonight she'll be let go," Herr Samsa said, but received an answer neither from his wife nor his daughter, for the charwoman seemed to have disturbed the equanimity they had only just attained. They rose from their seats, went to the window, and remained there with their arms about each other. Herr Samsa turned in his chair to look at them, and observed them quietly for a little while. Then he cried out, "So come here already. Let these old matters rest, and show a little consideration for me as well." At once the women obeyed, hurried over to him, caressed him, and quickly finished their letters. Then all three of them left the apartment together, something they had not done for months, and took the electric tram all the way to the open countryside at the edge of town. The car in which they sat all alone was entirely suffused with warm sunlight. Cozily leaning back in their seats, they discussed their future prospects, and on closer investigation, it appeared that these prospects were not bad at all. For all three of their positions, something they had never before properly discussed, were in fact quite advantageous, and above all offered promising opportunities for advancement. The greatest immediate improvement in their situation, of course, would be easily achieved by moving to a new apartment. They now wished to take a smaller and cheaper, but more convenient, and above all more practical flat than their current one, which had been picked out for them by Gregor. As they were conversing in this way, Herr and Frau Samsa were struck almost as one while observing their daughter, who was growing ever more vivacious, by the thought that despite all the torments that had made her cheeks grow pale, she had recently blossomed into a beautiful, voluptuous girl. Growing quieter now, and communicating with one another almost unconsciously by an exchange of glances, they thought about how it would soon be time to find her a good husband. And when they arrived at their destination, it seemed to them almost a confirmation of their new dreams and good intentions, when their daughter swiftly sprang to her feet and stretched her young body.
Afterward, The Death of a Salesman, Susan Bernofsky. Kafka's celebrated novella, The Metamorphosis, Die Verwandlung, was written a century ago, in late 1912, during a period in which he was having difficulty making progress on his first novel. On November 17th, 1912, Kafka wrote to his fiancée, Felice Bauer, that he was working on a story that came to me in my misery, lying in bed, and now was haunting him. He hoped to get it written down quickly. He hadn't yet realized how long it would be, as he felt it would turn out best if he could write it in just one or two long sittings. But there were many interruptions, and he complained to Felice several times that the delays were damaging the story. 3 weeks later it was finished, on December 7th, though it would be another 3 years before the story saw print. As we know from Max Brod's diary, Kafka read his bug piece, Wanzensache, aloud to friends on November 24th, 1912, the first section, and again on December 15th. People started talking about it, and Kafka received a query from publisher Kurt Wolf in March 1913 on the recommendation of Kafka's friend Franz Werfel. Franz Blei, the literary editor of the new avant-garde journal Die Weißen Blätter, expressed interest, and Robert Musil wrote as well, soliciting the novella for the more established Die Neue Rundschau, though it was technically too long for the magazine's format. But months passed before Kafka had a clean manuscript ready for submission, and then World War I intervened, causing further delays. Musil was called up to serve, and because of the war, Blei decided to stop printing literary texts. In the spring of 1915, René Schickele took over as editor-in-chief of Die Weißen Blätter, and with Max Brod's help, Kafka placed the story there. It came out in October 1915, and then appeared in December 1915, though dated 1916, as a slender volume published by Kurt Wolf Verlag in Leipzig. The story's protagonist, Gregor Samsa, is the quintessential Kafka anti-hero. He has worked himself to the point of utter exhaustion to pay off his parents' debts, and his grotesque metamorphosis is the physical manifestation of his abasement. What exactly is he transformed into? In Kafka's correspondence with his publisher, he was adamant that the insect, not be depicted on the jacket of the book. And although he and his friends used the word bug, Wanze, when referring casually to the story, the language that appears in the novella itself is carefully chosen to avoid specificity. The epithet ungeheures Ungeziefer in the opening sentence poses one of the greatest challenges to the translator. Both the adjective ungeheuer, meaning monstrous or huge, and the noun Ungeziefer are negations, virtual non-entities, prefixed by un. Ungeziefer comes from the Middle High German ungeziebere, a negation of the Old High German zeba, related to the Old English tiba, meaning sacrifice or sacrificial animal. An ungeziebere, then, is an unclean animal unfit for sacrifice, and ungeziefer describes the class of nasty, creepy, crawly things. The word in German suggests primarily six-legged critters, though it otherwise resembles the English word vermin, which refers primarily to rodents. Ungeziefer is also used informally as the equivalent of bug, though the connotation is dirty, nasty bug. You wouldn't apply the word to cute, helpful creatures like ladybugs. In my translation, Gregor is transformed into some sort of monstrous insect with some sort of added to blur the borders of the somewhat too specific insect. I think Kafka wanted us to see Gregor's new body and condition with the same hazy focus with which Gregor himself discovers them. That same blurred focus applies to other aspects of the story. Although Vladimir Nabokov, with his penchant for exactitude, has mapped out the Samsa flat in some detail, I am far from certain that Kafka himself, with his penchant for the blurred perceptions of bewilderment, was much concerned with the apartment's precise geography. How many rooms does this apartment have? Many. Too many. Just as Gregor, lying on his back in the story's opening sentences, discovers he has these many little legs waving in the air above him. Both are physical correlatives of a life that has gotten out of hand. Kafka is not even particularly attentive to the continuity of his cast of characters. Early on in the story, we see the maid give notice and flee, only to find her still working in the household several pages later, and in fact doing all the cooking, since now it is the cook who quit. Except for the charwoman, who plays a starring role in the penultimate scenes, the household help is just part of the furniture of the story, like the cabinet that gets shifted to another room. Even the main characters tend to appear categorically, named only by their functions, father, mother, sister. Only one of them gets a name. Greta rhymes with Beta. But even she is usually referred to only as sister throughout, until the decisive moment near the end when she becomes instead a daughter. By defining all these characters through their relationship to Gregor, Kafka slyly allows Gregor's point of view to dominate the story, even when he is not actually present in the scene being described. One leitmotif I was unable to preserve in translation is the theme of ruhig and unruhig. Ruhig denotes calm, peaceful, quiet, tranquil, at ease, and unruhig its opposite. Starting with the unruhigen Träumen, troubled dreams, in the first sentence, the narrative oscillates between untroubled and troubled, tranquil and harried, peaceful and unsettled. Since no one word in English fits well enough in all the contexts Kafka presents, I decided to translate the word in many different ways. But note when you are reading all these synonyms that you are watching a motif unfold. The post-metamorphosis activity that gives Gregor the greatest sense of freedom appears in my translation as crawling. He enjoys crawling around the walls and ceiling of his room. Ironically, the German verb kriechen, which also translates as to creep, has the additional meaning of to cower. To kriechen before someone is to act sycophantically toward him. In this sense, too, Gregor's new physical state appears as a representation of his long-standing spiritual abjectness. Finally, Gregor has only himself to blame for the wretchedness of his situation, since he has willingly accepted wretchedness as it was thrust upon him. Like others of Kafka's doomed protagonists, he errs by failing to act, instead allowing himself to be acted upon. Gregor Samsa, Giant Bug, is a cartoon of the subaltern, a human being turned inside out. He has traded in his spine for an exoskeleton, but even this armor-like shell, carapace and armor are the same word in German, Panzer, is no defense once his suddenly powerful father starts pelting him with apples, an ironically biblical choice of weapon. Gregor is a salesman, but what he's sold is himself, his own agency and dignity, making him a sellout through and through. For this reason, I occasionally use the word drummer, commercial traveler, to describe his profession, referring back to another of his ilk, a hard-working drummer who landed in the ash can like all the rest of them. That's Willy Loman as described by Arthur Miller in Death of a Salesman, 1949. The Metamorphosis is Kafka's own Death of a Salesman, with all the sad, grubby tragedy, all the squalor. Like Willy Loman, Gregor is a suicide, though of a different sort. He dies a hunger artist, perishing of starvation because nothing tastes good to him anymore. And, like Willie's, Gregor's death is the final service he performs for the benefit of his family. At the same time, Kafka's tragicomic tale, unlike Miller's, is very often hilariously funny. I imagine Kafka laughing uproariously when reading the story to his friends. Gregor's naivete, one might also call it gullibility, combined with his earnestness and his tendency to sound somewhat overwrought in his assertions, is perfectly risible. To bring out this side of the story, I've emphasized the slight tone of hysteria in Gregor's voice wherever it seemed justified. The story is brutally comic in parts, and never more so than at the moment when it is revealed that, despite the fact that Gregor has been living more or less as an indentured servant to pay off his parents' ancient debts, in fact, the family has plenty of money. Not enough to allow them to stop working altogether, but a proper little nest egg. And although they are described as poor, they are never too hard up to retain the services of at least one domestic servant. One last translation problem in the story is the title itself. Unlike the English metamorphosis, the German word Verwandlung does not suggest a natural change of state associated with the animal kingdom, such as the change from caterpillar to butterfly. Instead, it is a word from fairy tales, used to describe the transformation, say, of a girl's seven brothers into swans. But the word metamorphosis refers to this too. Its first definition in the Oxford English Dictionary is the action or process of changing in form, shape, or substance, especially transformation by supernatural means. This is the sense in which it's used, for instance, in translations of Ovid. As a title for this rich, complex story, it strikes me as the most luminous, suggestive choice. Finally, I would like to thank the friends and colleagues who helped me with suggestions and kind editorial interventions while I was working on this translation. Barbara Epler, Edith Grossman, Elliot Weinberger, Brian Mitchell, Christian Hawkey, Richard Gare, Emily Bauman, Amanda Hong, and especially Sean Cotter, Glenn Kurtz, and Tim Watson. I would also like to thank Carol Bemis, Thea Goodrich, Anne Edelman, and Eric Skruvala. New York, New York, August 2013.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Metamorphosis, a new translation by Susan Bernofsky. Written by Franz Kafka and Susan Bernofsky, translator. Performed by Eduardo Ballerini, with an introduction performed by Victor Bavine and an afterword performed by Crystal Lewis. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2014 by Susan Bernofsky. Introduction, David Cronenberg. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.